Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll take a look at the condition of our drinking water. We'll look at the national effort to improve water through the Safe Drinking Water Act, and a unique local arrangement to protect the New York City watershed by saving land which will avoid the necessity to build an $8 billion water filtration plant. On our Earth calendar, we'll explore why you can't resist that second helping of pie at this time of year. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. During the last couple of years, the Natural Resources Defense Council, a national environmental group, has been studying the quality of the water which you and I drink from the tap. Analyzing public and academic data, they came to some disturbing conclusions. Specifically, that over 45 million Americans drink water from plants that have found cryptosporidium, the protozoan that infected over 400,000 people and killed more than 100 in Milwaukee last year. That EPA and academic experts have estimated that millions of Americans are sickened by waterborne disease. That health hazards exist from widespread contaminants such as arsenic that were not previously understood. That over 53 million Americans drank water from systems that violated EPA standards. That many utilities hide the facts about contaminants in their systems. Last week, the Committee on Environment and Public Works in the United States Senate unanimously approved a new Safe Drinking Water Act. Committee Chairman John Chafee, Republican from Rhode Island, believes that the bill that he will be sending to the Senate floor is adequate and that it will permit smaller water systems to upgrade their plants where necessary.
I'm confident that the existing bill will ensure public health. This bill we've had a lot of hearings on. It came out of the committee unanimously. Every Democrat, every Republican voted for it. And I believe it's going to have smooth sailing on the floor, and I am confident that it is going to take care of the health requirements of our citizens.
Also enthusiastic is Diane Vandehy, who is the executive director of the Association of Metropolitan Water Agencies, which includes most of the big municipal drinking water systems in the country.
We're very supportive of the bill. It makes some reforms of the current law that were drastically needed, and I think that it represents the way legislation ought to be developed in this Congress and that it's a strong bipartisan bill.
But members of the environmental community do not share the enthusiasm of the industry representatives for the water suppliers.
My name is Eric Olson, and I'm a senior attorney at Natural Resources Defense Council. We think the bill that was reported out is a disappointment that although it does include a few positive provisions, such as a multi-billion-dollar trust fund that would help small systems come into compliance, there are several measures in it that would actually weaken protections for things like known human carcinogens, arsenic, and radon. And we're also concerned about several other provisions that would weaken current requirements. So although on balance it does have a few positive provisions in it, we, as an overall matter, are quite disappointed in the bill.
Of particular importance to the environmental community is an amendment that will be offered by Senator Boxer from California on the floor of the Senate, as described by Daniel Rosenberg, staff attorney for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group.
But we think that water utilities should be required once a year to provide their consumers with a report on what's in their drinking water and what the testing levels are for the different contaminants.
Water utilities are described as cold to this idea. The U.S. EPA, which is charged with the responsibility of administering the Safe Drinking Water Act, finds the new act acceptable but still in need of strengthening. Philip Metzger is the chief policy counsel in the Office of Water at EPA.
From the agency's perspective, we think this bill does set an acceptable framework for Safe Drinking Water Act reauthorization. It contains the principal elements that we were looking for in a reauthorization. That is, it has responsible measures for regulatory flexibility. It does have some authorities for preventive approaches to prevent contamination problems from occurring in the first place. And it does have funding for systems that need but currently can't afford treatment for their drinking water problems.
Congressional action on the Safe Water Drinking Act is expected to be completed before the winter break. I'm Peter Burley. At the beginning of the century, New York City built a vast water supply system by acquiring substantial lands in the Catskill Mountains 100 miles to the north. New York has had some of the best drinking water of any big city in America. But recently, increasing land development in the Catskill watershed and tighter federal regulations indicated the city would have to build an $8 billion filtration plant to filter its drinking water. The only alternative was to protect more Catskill land. This put the city squarely at odds with local communities which want to grow and improve their tax base. Recently, an historic agreement was reached with residents of the watershed, which should protect both the open land and the city drinking water without requiring the huge expenditure of a filtration plant. Thomas Lally reports.
Tannery Creek runs through the middle of Woodstock, New York, in the Catskill Mountains. It's about 120 miles from New York City, yet streams like this one is where the Big Apple gets most of its water. The water was well protected 100 years ago when the city chose the Catskills for its water source. But since then, the area has grown, and finding a way to balance further growth with the city's need for clean water has not been easy.
But the issue has always been who's going to pay for the cost of bearing that burden. And our fight for the last 5 years has been to shift that expense to back to the city. This fight has never been about pure water. People of the watershed have never deprecated the city's need for clean, pure water in copious quantities, hopefully unlimited quantities.
Anthony Buca is the supervisor of the town of Hunter, one of the many towns in New York's watershed. He and city officials routinely butted heads over the years over how to best approach the situation. Meanwhile, gasoline and other chemicals, sewage and agricultural runoff was all showing up in the city's water system, something that caught the eyes of federal officials who demanded that New York do something or be forced to build a costly filtration plant. The city's response was to propose strict land use regulations.
And out of that came a threat and a feeling that our, you know, future, our hopes, if you may, our private property rights were being not only threatened but taken away from us. Meanwhile, the city was facing $4 to $8 billion in costs of developing a filtration plant, which probably wouldn't work anyway.
Richard Coombe is a beef and crop farmer from Neversink, New York, and chair of the Watershed Agricultural Council. At first, the city's regulations were opposed by nearly everyone in the watershed. Lawsuits were filed to stall any restrictions on land use. But Coombe began to realize that faced with the prospect of building a filtration plant, the city could spend far less by preserving some land and managing the rest.
So all of a sudden, a group of us realized that this was a lose-lose situation. Maybe we should at least talk about turning it into a win-win.
And the city agreed. Recently, the city and watershed towns signed on to a comprehensive land protection plan. It requires the city to pay for some services that will help maintain water quality. And in exchange, towns and farmers in the watershed will comply with new regulations. Lawrence Beckhart directs the Watershed Agricultural Program for the New York City Department of Environmental Protection. He says incentive rather than punitive-based programs like this one are the most effective.
Well, it is a bargain. This is it's so far been a successful program. We haven't yet enacted our new regulations, and yet we've gotten 200 farmers signed up to participate in this program of protecting water quality. And if you compare the cost of this program to the cost of filtration, which is, would be several billion dollars, it certainly is a bargain. Even regardless of filtration, the good source water protection with or without filtration makes sense. The cost of filtration is reduced. The efficiency of a filtration plant is maximized when you have clean water going into that plant.
In the past, the opposite was accepted as truth. Filtration was considered the best way to maintain clean drinking water. But filtration is expensive, and today we're finding it's not always effective. Ike Eichert from the Catskill Conservation Center says land preservation is the best way to preserve safe drinking water. Here at a conference on economic development in the Catskills, environmentalists like Eichert are welcomed. That's because part of the city's new agreement with watershed towns calls for a balance between environmental and economic concerns.
Yeah, I think this does signal the end of thinking of filtration as being the answer. I mean, as was demonstrated in Milwaukee several years ago, where something like 100 people died and 400,000 were sick with cryptosporidium, and that was at a level of filtration that was anticipated as the level of filtration the city, New York City, would have to achieve in this situation. Filtration is not sufficient, and this negotiated settlement is an acknowledgement of that. But much more than filtration, we've got to protect the watersheds in the first place.
Eichert says even as recently as a year ago, few people thought this dispute would be resolved outside of the courts. But today, people from around the country and the world are taking notes. Congressman Maurice Hinchey represents many areas in the watershed. He says the resolution of this controversy should serve as a model for other disputes over natural resources.
Well, I think what it means is that you can cooperate, that people with seemingly diverse interests and perhaps a different agenda can nevertheless cooperate in ways that can be mutually beneficial and at the same time achieve a larger purpose, as was achieved here, that larger purpose being the protection of an extraordinary resource that is absolutely essential to life and is, in fact, irreplaceable.
Back in Woodstock, life around Tannery Creek is waking up. Shops are opening and late-season tourists are beginning to venture out. It seems improbable that this creek, with houses and stores built right up to its shore and cars and trucks driving over it, would be a source of some of the cleanest drinking water in the nation. But it is. And everyone is keeping their fingers crossed that under this new plan, it will remain so. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
The Environment Show would really like to hear from you. Do we entertain you? Do we bore you? Do we teach you anything? Write us at P.O. Box 66600, Albany, New York, 12206-6600, or reach us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. I'm Peter Berling. Still ahead, we'll look at the condition of freshwater mussels who are more affected by the quality of water than we are. We'll speak with a researcher who has led treks to isolated parts of Laos and Myanmar. In his last trip, 10 animals totally new to science were discovered. And our Earth calendar will explore why you're more likely to reach for that second helping of pie at this time of year. Your hunter-gatherer ancestors might just be to blame. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Freshwater mussels are one of the many creatures which help keep our water clean. These lowly animals filter water and provide food for other animals. Scientists refer to mussels as an indicator species because if they're having trouble, it's a good bet the rest of the ecosystem is too. Thomas Lally reports on how mussels are losing ground like never before.
Scientists say you don't have to go to a rainforest to see a major extinction event. It's happening right here in the U.S. Although there are nearly 300 species of freshwater mussels found across the country, most reside in Alabama. About a fifth are extinct, and another 30% are close to extinction. Dr. Charles Lydiard studies mussels at the University of Alabama. He says the writing is on the wall.
If all these different types of creatures are disappearing in the rivers and streams of Alabama and the Southeast in general, then that's a sign of an unhealthy ecosystem, and something needs to be done to try to rectify that problem.
Lydiard says mussels have a hard time adapting when ecosystems are altered. For instance, many mussels go through a parasitic stage early in life when they attach themselves to fish before reaching maturity.
Well, if you build a dam in a river, what happens is you now no longer have a free-flowing river. So fish that do not like to hang around in a lake or a reservoir, which is what's constructed after you build a dam, you will now change the fish community. Well, when you change the fish community, these mussels, which often rely on particular species of fishes, will no longer be able to find their appropriate host species, and basically you'll have this sterile population, or what could be considered virtually a sterile population of adult clams sitting there waiting for their host to come that's never going to come.
And mussels aren't alone. Freshwater fish, snails, and turtles are also facing declining numbers in the Southeast. Lydiard says to reverse this trend, we'll have to change the way we think about little creatures like mussels. He says they may not be the most charismatic animals, but they signify that our ecosystems right here in the U.S. share the peril we often associate with other countries. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
No discussion of the environment takes place without a mention of biodiversity, the variety of life which inhabits our Earth. At a time when species are becoming extinct even before they have been cataloged, it's refreshing to know that some naturalists are still discovering big four-legged creatures that scientists have not classified before. Dr. Alan Rabinowitz is a researcher for the Wildlife Conservation Society, and his current project is studying the animals of Laos and Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. On his last trip, he ventured into the remote Annamite Mountains in search of an animal found in Vietnam called a pseudo-oryx, which he describes as a cross between a cow and an antelope.
Now, while we were looking for this animal, we discovered a completely new kind of barking deer, a new kind of deer species, which looks similar to the more common barking deer species, but is larger and it's darker. And what we first thought were just several anomalous animals, we started finding all over the place, and then the local people told us, yes, there are two different animals out there, and sure enough, they're still alive and fairly common up there in the Annamite mountain range, and we called that the giant barking deer. Now, shortly after that, we found in one of the villagers that somebody was holding another kind of deer, which none of us had ever seen. It was about half the size of the common barking deer, much darker, and it looked very different from any other barking deer. This looked to be a new species, and we're right now calling it the little black barking deer, but we've only found one animal, and right after we found that one animal, the villagers killed it and ate it. So now we're going back into the forest and seeking this new species, which is completely new to science. In the meantime, we brought some small mammal specialists, some fish specialists up into this area. We had a bat specialist stay in the area for 2 weeks. He captured 9 different bat species, and so far, 3 of them have been documented as being completely new to science. We brought a fish specialist up there, and that ichthyologist started capturing fish, and he found that at least 4 of the fish species are completely new to science. We just randomly picked up spiders in order to send back to a specialist in the United States that asked us to bring him some spiders, and just from picking up random spiders in the forest, we found one new species of spider. So the area, oh, and also while we were up there, we rediscovered a completely new, we rediscovered a new pig species called the Vietnamese warty hog, which had only been documented once 50 years ago from a Jesuit priest and then never reported or seen of again. And we found that these pigs are fairly abundant up in this Annamite mountain range.
Now, how this is very exciting, and how common are these opportunities? I mean, are there a lot of places like the Annamite Mountains across the world, or is this a very special place?
No, these opportunities. This is something which a scientist like myself or a field person only dreams about or reads old books about, and thinks that it's from a time lost. To be quite honest with you, when I was first up in the Annamite Mountain Range, it's such an incredibly rugged area that even before finding these new species, it reminded me of when I was a youngster reading Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Lost World. And then when we started finding these new animals, it truly is the equivalent of Doyle's The Lost World. And this area is so special that we're trying to draw international attention to it, and right now we have some people looking to maybe designate it a World Biosphere Reserve.
While Dr. Rabinowitz discovers the animals our hunter-gatherer ancestors pursued in the jungle, the genes of our early humans may well send signals we still respond to today as reflected in our Earth calendar. In previous weeks, we have talked about migrations and changes in weather patterns which affect wildlife in the fall. But this week, we consider what effect the coming of winter has on ourselves. Dr. Iroh Akeen, Associate Director of the Division of Cardiovascular Medicine at the University of Massachusetts, is researching the phenomenon he has observed that human cholesterol levels rise when winter approaches and then go back down again in the spring.
We screened some 4,000 people in a health maintenance organization in central Massachusetts, and I was surprised to find that there was striking seasonal variation of cholesterol levels, with cholesterols being about 20 points higher in the winter than in the summer. And that may not sound like much, but in fact it's very important if you choose a level at which you send people for further testing or treatment. One such level that's been suggested is 240 milligrams to separate high from low or high from normal. In the winter, that would identify 28% of our patients as being high, and in the summer it would only be 11%.
The question, then, is what causes this fall phenomenon?
It may, in fact, be in part diet and exercise, and I think diet is certainly a very important part of this. But the real question is, what drives that? Why is it that we eat more at certain times of the year and less at others? And my own personal suspicion is that it's light exposure.
Dr. Akeen, like the naturalists who wonder about the migrations of butterflies, birds, and fish, speculates that we too have some kind of internal clock which was set in our genes ages ago.
We may think we're sophisticated, but there's a lot of the primitive, there's a lot of that hunter-gatherer ancestor of ours still in our genes, and something says to us in the fall, it's getting dark, it's getting cold, it's time to get fat because the acorns may be hard to find. We need to recognize these incredible natural rhythms in our lives and to some extent go with them and not fight them, but it means that we need to recognize that people tend to eat more in the fall, that we need to somehow work with our patients so that they recognize this and are not quite so tempted, provide alternatives. I think it's particularly interesting that our great gorging holiday is in the fall, you know, Thanksgiving, and that some of our fasting events like Lent are in the spring, when it's perhaps more physiologic to do that.
And so as you prepare for Thanksgiving and contemplate the overindulgence which is sure to occur despite your best intentions, rest assured that you are simply responding to a natural instinct, and don't feel guilty about eating that extra piece of pumpkin pie. Thanks for joining us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 306. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer. Dr. Alan Chartog is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and see you next week.